Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 45, November 8, 2010. USDA to boost biofuels. Effort could break big oil's grip, create thousands of new jobs, by James P. Tucker, Jr. The Obama administration is undertaking a massive effort to promote the use of alternative fuels in motor vehicles as a means of gaining energy independence, farm prosperity, job creation, and economic improvements, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced on October 21st. Domestic production of renewable energy, including biofuels, is a national imperative, and that's why USDA is working to assist in developing a biofuels industry in every corner of the nation, Vilsack said in a meeting with reporters at the National Press Club in Washington. By producing more biofuels in America, we will create jobs, combat global warming, replace our dependence on foreign oil, and build a stronger foundation for the economy. While the claim that global warming is caused by industrialization has been largely debunked, Vilsack said a final rule to implement the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, BCAP, will be published. Under the BCAP final rule, USDA will resume making payments to eligible producers. The program had operated as a pilot pending publication of a final rule. BCAP was authorized by the Food, Conservation, and Energy Act of 2008. It is intended to ensure that a sufficiently large base of new, non-food, non-feed biomass crops is established to meet future demand for renewable energy. The Obama administration is aggressively supporting our nation's farmers, ranchers, and producers of biofuels as they work to bring greater energy independence to America, Vilsack said. BCAP will help the nation's power, bio-based product, and advanced biofuel industries produce energy from sustainable rural resources and create jobs that will stimulate rural economies across the nation. Vilsack said the BCAP final regulation reflects policies developed as a result of more than 24,000 comments received on previous Federal Register notices and knowledge gained by implementing a portion of the program in 2009. Vilsack also announced a five-year agreement with the Federal Aviation Administration to develop fuel from forest and crop residues and other green feedstocks in order to reduce dependence on foreign oil and stabilize aviation fuel costs. Under the partnership, the agencies will bring together their experience in research, policy analysis, and air transportation sector dynamics to assess the availability of different kinds of feedstocks that could be processed by biorefineries to produce jet fuels. Vilsack said that a department report found that the biofuels industry becomes more productive as cost-reducing technology is applied, which results in higher wages for workers. Gains in gross domestic product and real income are driven largely by technological progress in biofuels, which increases economic productivity. The next generation of biofuels is expected to be a decreasing-cost industry, meaning the cost of producing ethanol will drop. Page 2. Personal from the editor. The Outer Limits. Storm teams at network news affiliates are always scanning the skies to warn us of possible gloom and doom. Their heroics went into hyperdrive during the October 26th to 27th superstorm brought about by bombogenesis that marched through the nation from the upper Midwest to the deep South, spawning several tornadoes. Media people adore the weather. It's often dramatic news involving possible property destruction, power outages, potential death, etc. Also, weather reporting is safe. No one can be held responsible, even though mayhem and destruction can occur. There are no conspirators to unmask, no scandals to unravel. The news and entertainment media treat most political matters like the weather. In movies, music, books, and in news reports, we hear terms like the winds of war and winds of change, giving the impression that most things are random. But former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, during the first season of his True TV series on conspiracies, ventured to the remote HAARP outpost in Alaska, exploring the question that most people dismiss: can mankind control or influence the weather? That is a tough one to answer, but there is growing suspicion that the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, or HAARP, an antenna array that transmits energy beams into the ionosphere, may be more than an advanced means of military communications. Heating up the ionosphere layer that protects the Earth from intense solar radiation, including charged particle storms from solar winds, is seen as a risky practice that could rupture that protective layer. While there will be more on this subject in future AFPs, several commentators and researchers want the government to fully explain whether HARP is capable of weather control. This is an interesting line of inquiry, especially after the strange big storm that just ended called a hurricane on land. We are often told by the Federal Reserve that the economy is heating up or cooling down. If it's possible that the weather can be manipulated like the Fed manipulates the market while pretending most economic trends are random, then mankind's lust for control literally knows no limits. If that isn't enough, we learn in this edition, see page 6, that Cleveland, Ohio is among the cities considering using tracking chips and trash bins to force people to recycle plastics and other recyclables so the city can gather such materials and rake in revenue. But like a storm team of a different sort, AFP is providing advanced warning so readers can prevent their town from criminalizing trash collection. News you may have missed. Ford, world's most profitable automaker? American Motor Company Ford again surprised analysts by turning an impressive profit once more for the third quarter. So far this year, the Dearborn, Michigan automaker has made $6.3 billion, paired with a $14.3 billion loss in 2008. Ford executives are even talking about boosting fourth quarter vehicle output in North America, which could earn it the title of the world's most profitable automaker. That designation is currently held by Germany's Volkswagen Group. Unpopular in a good way? According to a survey by the Jerusalem Post, only 10% of Israelis think Barack Obama supports their country sufficiently, while 46% think he is pro-Palestine. Thus, Obama is one of the most unpopular in Israel U.S. presidents ever. George II Bush, who launched wars of aggression against Iraq and Afghanistan, making him the most popular in Israel U.S. president, was approved by 88% of Israelis. In an interview on Channel 2 Israeli TV, Obama said he feels his Arabic middle name contributes to his unpopularity in Israel. But for all his unpopularity in Israel, Obama is not particularly popular in Palestine either, as the Palestinians tend to view him as favoring hardline Israelis. Helping Brave Lady. Kalispell, Montana resident Kathleen Folden is the courageous truck driver who, as reported in AFP number 44, November 1st, 2010, drove hundreds of miles to use a crowbar to smash a shocking art display that insulted Christians by portraying Jesus as a homosexual. Those who want to donate funds to help her with their legal expenses can contact her attorney, Cliff Strickland, at Holm, Roberts & Owens, LLP, 1700 Lincoln Street, number 4100, Denver, Colorado, 80203-4541. Call 303-861-7000. If financial aid is sent, be sure to make it out to Kathleen Folden. Emperor Barack. The royal entourage traveling with Barack Obama on his upcoming trip to India has booked all of the 570 rooms in the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai, as well as another 300 rooms in a neighboring luxury hotel. Obama's contingent is huge, an anonymous Indian security official told London's Telegraph newspaper. There are two jumbo jets coming along with Air Force One, which will be flanked by security jets. The president's convoy has 45 cars. In addition, reports the Telegraph, U.S. naval destroyers will be positioned just off the coast of India. Reportedly, Michelle Obama will be visiting the red light district of Mumbai to talk to the working girls to learn about their private lives. Secret Club. In the lead-up to the recent High Court ruling that allowed corporations to fund politicians and political campaigns, Supreme Court Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas attended secret meetings with a group of billionaires whose sole agenda is to block government from regulating corporations. Scalia and Thomas came down on the side of the majority, which ruled in favor of the wealthy elites using their money to influence U.S. elections. Long-term investing. So much for investing in the market to help businesses grow, reports market analyst Peter Cohan at AOL's Daily Finance. 70% of trading volume on the major exchanges is conducted by high-frequency traders who hold a stock for an average of 11 seconds. Drug pollution. A recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey has uncovered shocking evidence of pollution around drug factories. When scientists compared water samples from areas around major drug makers to samples from other parts of the country, they found significantly higher levels of pollution. Researchers concluded that the pharmaceutical plants had been simply flushing unused drugs down the drain, which would then wind up in nearby watersheds. No More Profit for Rand Paul. Tim Profit, Rand Paul's campaign coordinator in Bourbon County, Kentucky, has been charged with stepping on the head of a liberal activist and pinning her face to the concrete. He said the scuffle was not as bad as it looked on video, while blaming police for not intervening. I'm sorry that it came to that, and I apologize if it appeared overly forceful, but I was concerned about Rand's safety. Before a debate between Paul, the Tea Party favorite, and Democrat Jack Conway, Vallee claimed she was roughed up as she tried to lampoon Paul for being a corporate stooge. Page 4, The Dark Side with Victor Thorne. Murdered Intern Had Something Important to Tell by Victor Thorne. Similar to Monica Lewinsky, did Chandra Levy potentially fill the role of a Mossad espionage seductress? Following her May 2001 disappearance, headlines inundated the public with titillating details of a deviant affair with Representative Gary Condit, Democrat, California. 8 years after her dead body was discovered in Washington, D.C.'s Rock Creek Park, the murder trial of Ingmar Guantique, a non-English-speaking Salvadoran illegal immigrant, is set to begin. However, questions arise as to whether Guantique or Condit had any involvement in this crime. Instead, Ms. Levy's political connections provide an abundance of other alternatives. After interning for Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon and California Governor Gray Davis, Ms. Levy began a similar stint at the Federal Bureau of Prisons, BOP, in D.C. With access to highly sensitive data in this position, Ms. Levy became involved with Condit, who sat on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Her influence also included a friendship with Republican strategist Karl Rove, while at the same time securing a VIP seat for George W. Bush's 2001 inauguration. For a woman in her early 20s, Ms. Levy was perfectly positioned to be a honeypot, or a swallow, as the Mossad calls attractive female operatives. In an article entitled, What Really Happened to Chandra Levy?, former Mossad agent James Besser commented on their insidious tactics. Operation Dumb Eagle is a codename for the spy agency's extensive efforts to infiltrate top levels of the U.S. government through the placement of American Jews in sensitive positions. Part of Operation Dumb Eagle is the recruitment, training, and placement of attractive Jewish co-eds as U.S. interns. Like Ms. Lewinsky, Ms. Levy was Jewish, with her family attending Beth Shalom Temple in California. In line with their faith, Ms. Levy and her mother traveled to Israel only 2 months prior to her disappearance. Upon returning, Ms. Levy continued her duties at the BOP, where, according to Besser's July 19, 2001 article, she was involved in choosing the people who would observe Timothy McVeigh's execution. Considering the well-chronicled role of the Southern Poverty Law Center, FBI, CIA, and BAT ATF operatives in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, for which McVeigh was convicted as a co-conspirator, Condit told Parade magazine on September 9, 2001, that Ms. Levy exhibited an incredible interest in Middle East policy, terrorism, and the McVeigh case. Further, while interning at the BOP, Ms. Levy would have been aware that psychiatrist Dr. Louis Jolyon West visited McVeigh at least 17 times. As a protege of Jewish MK-Ultra director Sidney Gottlieb, West also diagnosed Jack Ruby as being insane and paranoid, rather than possessing any conspiratorial knowledge about John F. Kennedy's 1963 assassination. In addition, West visited Sirhan Sirhan in prison after he played the mind-controlled patsy in Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 murder. Oddly enough, McVeigh claimed to have been implanted with a microchip during his service in the first Gulf War. After being convicted, along with Terry Nichols, for the still-unsolved OKC bombing, McVeigh had originally been slated for execution on May 16, 2001. But after this date was rescheduled, Ms. Levy prematurely and unexpectedly received her termination notice from BOP officials. Days later, she went missing, but only after telling her aunt and confidant, Linda Zamsky, that she had something big and important to tell her. Less than 2 weeks later, McVeigh supposedly died from a lethal injection. Controversy has surrounded his death because eyewitnesses Susan Carlson of Chicago's WLSAM reported, he appeared to still be breathing, or what appeared to be shallow breathing. Even after being pronounced dead, his eyes remained open. Susan Carlson was friends with Ms. Levy. Around the same time, Ms. Levy disappeared while jogging in Rock Creek Park in May 2001. A year later, after an exhaustive search, Ms. Levy's skeletal remains turned up not far from where she was running. And what makes circumstances even more peculiar, the FBI's primary detective assigned to examine Miss Levy's disappearance was Special Agent Bradley Garrett. Not only did Garrett assist in the widespread cover-up of White House Deputy Counsel Vince Foster's so-called suicide at Washington's Fort Marcy Park, he also spearheaded an inept investigation into the murder of Capitol Hill intern Mary Mahoney. By all accounts, Mahoney boasted of writing a memoir that chronicled an array of White House sexcapades. Shortly thereafter, as Douglas Herman wrote on January 4, 2004, Mary and two co-workers were gunned down, execution style, with silenced pistols in a trendy Georgetown Starbucks. Although two guns were used and no money was stolen, police pinned the slaying on habitual criminal Carl Cooper after interrogating him for 54 hours. Cooper later recanted, saying his confession came under duress. Is Salvadoran illegal immigrant Guandique going to be likewise railroaded with a conviction that will finally sweep under the rug a messy bimbo eruption that involved congressmen, Israeli intelligence, and OKC bombing participants? Interestingly, Guandique initially passed a lie detector test in 2002 and was officially ruled out as a suspect at that time. That evidence has been ruled inadmissible in his trial. Page 6, AFP on Big Brother. Big Brother's trash talk. Cities plan to mandate recycling. We'll use high-tech tracking methods. By Pat Shannon. The city fathers of Cleveland, Ohio, have announced the latest Orwellian leap in America with their plans to introduce a high-tech trash and recycling collection system next year. The new carts will be embedded with radio frequency identification chips and barcodes. The chips will tell city workers how often residents have been rolling carts to the curb for recycling collection. If a chip shows a recyclable cart hasn't been brought to the curb in weeks, a trash supervisor will sort through the trash for recyclables. Waste Collection Commissioner Ronnie Owens told Cleveland's Plain Dealer that trash carts containing more than 10% recyclable throwaways could lead to a $100 fine. These include glass, metal cans, plastic bottles, paper, and cardboard. Not only is it a thinly veiled new thrust at gaining revenue through civil fines akin to seatbelts and stoplight cameras, but it also is a fundraising scheme to enhance the city's treasury by selling product for which it paid nothing. Cleveland pays $30 a ton to dump garbage in landfills, but earns $26 a ton for recyclables. Landlords are responsible for making sure their tenants follow the new statute, but property owners are already plotting how to avoid the detection. One told AFP that he wasn't sure how sophisticated the chips might be, but he surmised that all he need do to beat the system would be to roll his cart to the street and back once a week and let it log the distance whether it was loaded or not. The Cleveland City Council in August approved spending $2.5 million on high-tech carts for 25,000 households across the city, expanding a lesser pilot program that began in 2007. The program will continue expanding at 25,000 households a year for the next 5 years before encompassing the city's 150,000 residences. Existing carts might be retrofitted with the microchips. Alexandria, Virginia had approved the chip-embedded carts, and the system is just starting to catch on elsewhere. The Plain Dealer reported that a citywide public service campaign to educate residents about the new collection system and recycling program will begin soon. We're trying to make sure Cleveland stays clean and residents are properly informed on how these things should be set out, Owens said. Not to mention that the $400,000 garnered from the new goal will be about 8 times the revenue derived only 2 years ago. Councilman Martin Keene cautioned against overzealous enforcement of the new statute, saying that he would prefer that the Division of Waste Collection and use more discretion when deciding whether to issue a ticket or maybe only a warning to first-time offenders. From the amount of water in our toilets to dangerous mercury-laden light bulbs and now to trash control, we are reminded of the popular country singer Merle Haggard, who was a bad boy in his youth, who recently said, "In 1960, when I came out of prison as an ex-convict, I had more freedom under parolee supervision than there's available to an average citizen in America right now." Page 7, AFP on reverse racism. White kids shafted. Corporate America backs Latino students. By William D. Johnson. Major corporations such as FedEx, Lowe's, McDonald's, Wells Fargo, Verizon, the Wachovia Foundation, and dozens of others have lined up to financially support a private organization dedicated to ensuring that Hispanics get to college ahead of white American kids. The Hispanic Scholarship Fund, HSF, says that it aims to put a degree in every Latino household by 2025 through its Affirmative Action Program in college recruitment. Funding for the HSF comes from a large number of corporations. According to the organization's website, these include, in addition to the above mentioned, the Mazda Foundation, Class Time, GMAC Financial Services, the McNamara Family Foundation, Inc., Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, Toyota Motor Sales USA, Target, the Morgan Stanley Foundation, Nissan North America, the Sally May Fund, the Draper Family Foundation, the Shell Oil Company, and the UPS Foundation, among many others. The HSF says specifically that it is only for Latinos and those of Hispanic descent. On the HSF's website, under their Frequently Asked Questions section, the policy is spelled out in no uncertain terms. Do I have to be Hispanic Latino to apply, the website asks? The answer is equally frank. Yes. The HSF said that it aims to raise the rate of degree achievement among Hispanics from 19% to 60%. According to Andy Pino, spokesman for the organization, during the last 35 years, the organization has awarded about $300 million in scholarships to more than 50,000 Hispanic students. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. Senators should be commended for stalling 420 hasty House bills. The mainstream media can often be heard blasting the do-nothing Congress, but as most AFP readers know, it's far better to have a bumbling and effective do-nothing Congress than an efficient, productive legislative body that every day churns out new, invasive, rights-robbing laws. As the midterm elections approached in late October, the mainstream media went on the offensive against the Senate for failing to address 420 bills that had been passed by the House. A popular Capitol Hill daily went so far as to assail senators for the gulf in productivity between the two chambers. The truth is, Americans should be lauding the Senate for sidelining many of the bills that the House quickly sent to the upper chamber. The majority of the measures are relatively harmless, such as legislation that names post offices after famous Americans and a bill that encourages Americans to get screened for diabetes. And there are even a few gems in the mix, such as the Local Radio Community Act that calls on federal officials to hand out more licenses to non-commercial, localized radio stations, and legislation that supports domestic production of rare earth metals such as uranium and gadolinium. But some are controversial and extremely troubling, and the Senate should be applauded for not grinding them through as if our elected representatives were making sausage. For example, the House-passed cap-and-trade bill is languishing in a Senate committee where it will hopefully get rigor mortis and die. Cap-and-trade refers to a new environmental proposal that would force federal carbon emission standards on all U.S. corporations. These would be sold to companies in the form of permits. That is the cap. Factories that could not immediately meet these guidelines would have to turn to other companies that have the ability to reduce their emissions in order to buy or borrow additional permits so as not to be in violation of government rules. That's what is known as the trade. Another bad bill the Senate is sitting on is the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act, which has been characterized as the most sweeping update of food safety rules in the United States in more than 50 years. Critics of the bill say it is one of the most dangerous pieces of legislation ever introduced in Congress. Among other things, the bill puts all foods and farms under the control of the Homeland Security Department and the Department of Defense in the event of contamination or non-specific national emergency. It allows the government to label the sale of any food, even between individuals, as smuggling in the United States. It imposes a global system of compliance on food in line with the World Trade Organization. It forces organic growers to use antibiotics and hormones when a state of emergency is declared. It removes an American's right to clean, store, and save your own seeds from your garden. It puts the production of all meat into the hands of corporations, the worst offenders when it comes to food quality and safety. Representative Cantor wants aid to Israel immune to cuts. With heavy pressure coming on Congress to institute fiscal responsibility and lower the deficit, one of the major issues that is taking heat is foreign aid, which accounts for over $50 billion of the federal budget every year. This has put Republicans in a quandary. They want to cut spending, except to Israel. What's their solution? Representative Eric Cantor, Republican Virginia, who is hoping to become majority leader if the Republicans take control of Congress, wants to remove the taxpayer dollars handed to Israel from the foreign aid budget in order to insulate the Israelis from any cuts in funding. In an interview with JTA, an Israeli news agency, Cantor, the only Jewish Republican in the House, said, Part of the dilemma is that Israel has been put in the overall foreign aid looping. I'm hoping we can see some kind of separation in terms of tax dollars going to Israel. In 2010, Israel received $2.8 billion from U.S. taxpayers, the most received by any country. Since the majority of those funds go to buy more weapons and, no doubt, to propagandize Americans, Cantor would like to see the Israeli foreign aid handouts merge directly with U.S. military appropriations. According to published reports, one quarter of the Israeli military budget is paid for by U.S. taxpayers. Sadly, Democrats appear to be more concerned with the fact that Republicans want to cut foreign aid than with the fact that a wealthy country like Israel continues to receive billions in handouts as Americans struggle to find jobs, stay in their homes, and eat. $1.4 billion in TARP ends up as payback for GOP candidates. AFP has reported on this development in recent issues, but with mandatory financial disclosure forms submitted by politicians and political organizations now in, the proof is finally here. Companies that receive taxpayer-funded bailouts from politicians are now donating to political campaigns in record amounts. Among companies with political action committees, the 23 that received $1 billion or more in federal money through the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, gave a total of $1.4 million to candidates in September, up from $466,000 the month before, reports the Washington Post. Ironically, much of the money from the bailed-out corporations is going to Republicans, who openly oppose new regulations on Wall Street. All but one Democrat had supported the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, the landmark measure that sought to rein in out-of-control gambling among banks and other financial firms. On the other hand, only three Republicans voted for the bill, meaning that the overwhelming majority of Republicans were perfectly content with Wall Street continuing its fleecing of Main Street. The two top candidates to receive donations from TARP-funded companies are, not surprisingly, the two top House Republicans, Minority Leader John Boehner, Ohio, who was gifted with $200,000, and Whip Eric Cantor, Virginia, who was handed $187,000. The ranking members of two key House financial committees followed Boehner and Cantor, Representatives Spencer Baucus, Alabama, who was on the Financial Services Committee, and Dave Camp, Michigan, who was on the Ways and Means Committee. Scott Talbot, a lobbyist with the Financial Services Roundtable, a leading Wall Street lobbying firm, cried to the Post that Democrats had hurt the banksters' feelings when they characterized them as fat cats and greedy, and that's why they're donating to them in record amounts. The entire industry was painted with a broad brush, whined Talbot, and there was dissatisfaction with that. Page 10, one-on-one with Victor Thorne. Victor Thorne interviews former CNN reporter who was first on scene at Pentagon on 9/11 by Victor Thorne. There's an old saying, don't spit on my leg and tell me it's raining. Likewise, don't show me a photo taken only minutes after the 9/11 Pentagon event and insist that a Boeing 757, which is 155 feet long with a 124-foot wingspan and weighs 100 tons, crashed into America's military nerve center. During an October 19th interview, this writer questioned former CNN correspondent Jamie McIntyre about the 200,000 pounds of missing wreckage. McIntyre was one of the first establishment reporters on the scene soon after the Pentagon event and has been cited repeatedly by researchers exploring alternative views about what happened on the morning of September 11, 2001. McIntyre tried to explain. What was left of the plane broke into thousands of tiny pieces. Most of it was destroyed. However, McIntyre's own words delivered during a live CNN broadcast on the morning of September 11, 2001 betray this sentiment. From my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. That tragic morning, he continued. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon. Later, as possible damage control, McIntyre objected that his comments were taken out of context. But were they? Pentagon officials initially excused lack of physical wreckage by saying the plane, including its black boxes and flight data recorders, vaporized. Yet, deceased employees and passengers were identified by DNA, fingerprints, and driver's licenses. How could aluminum and high-grade steel completely disintegrate while flesh and plastic documents remained intact? McIntyre responded, "It's inexplicable how some stuff survives. It's a fluky situation what makes it through and what doesn't. It's not inconsistent for some fragile things to survive while other strong things don't." In other words, we're supposed to believe this preposterous spin instead of our own eyes. Also, why is only one 18-foot hole visible on the Pentagon's exterior ring? Government spokesman said it was created by Flight 77's fuselage, yet a Boeing's nose is described by aviation experts as a weak eggshell, a sausage skin, or an empty beer can. Airplane mechanics cast serious doubt on whether a fuselage could penetrate three immensely strong reinforced concrete walls. McIntyre admitted to AFP that never once did he interview any structural engineers to determine why the plane's 5-ton engines didn't create any holes. In fact, McIntyre never interviewed a single pilot to determine if Hani Hanjour, who could barely drive an automobile and was refused permission to rent a Cessna prop plane months before 9/11, could have commandeered the large, sophisticated, unwieldy aircraft said to have hit the Pentagon. He called the matter immaterial. Moreover, McIntyre failed to interview any air traffic controllers to ascertain whether a Boeing 757 could execute a 7,000-foot drop in 2.5 minutes while pulling a sharp 270-degree turn. Nor did he interview a single airline technician to verify if this aircraft could perform such Top Gun maneuvers. Neither did he contact a single physician in regard to whether Hanjour would have lost consciousness in flight due to the G-forces. McIntyre also neglected to interview any photographic experts or search and rescue workers in regard to why no wreckage appeared in the initial photos. Additionally, Professor A.K. Dewdney of Western Ontario University conducted numerous experiments which determined that cell phone calls could not have been made by passengers that morning. Such technology only became available in 2004. Pilot Russ Wittenberg confirmed to AFP that these devices couldn't lock onto cell towers from the heights or speeds claimed by the government. Inexplicably, McIntyre didn't contact a single electronics expert to verify the authenticity of these calls. When asked if he viewed any of the 84 confiscated videotapes that the Pentagon has refused to release under FOIA requests to this day, McIntyre responded in the negative. AFP followed up, "Has there ever been any conclusive video footage where Flight 77 is unmistakably seen striking the Pentagon?" McIntyre replied, "As far as we know, there is no video footage comparable to WTC-2 being struck in New York." Despite the Pentagon's enormous surveillance systems, the government can't produce even one identifiable photograph of Flight 77 crashing into this highly secure facility. Moreover, McIntyre didn't witness the crash and only arrived on the scene 45 minutes later. Worse, he confessed to not doing any research into alternate explanations while adding, "I'm not aware of anyone at CNN exploring these subjects in any detail." By his own admission, McIntyre couldn't provide evidence of interviewing a single individual whose perspective differed from the government's official version of 9/11. He justified this lack of intellectual and journalistic curiosity with the following mantras: A. All evidence points in only one direction. B. There are no plausible alternatives. C. These aren't relevant lines of questioning. And D. All this might make sense if we didn't know whether American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. But we do know that for a fact, so all this other debate and analysis is irrelevant. Unfortunately, McIntyre still does not realize that this type of lazy, elitist arrogance is why a growing number of Americans don't trust the corporate media. He did acknowledge, "It's good to keep an open and skeptical mind because the government doesn't always tell the truth." But by neglecting to investigate a single aspect of this story that contradicts the government's version, CNN, McIntyre, and his mainstream media colleagues epitomize lapdog journalism at its shoddiest. Page 11, AFP on 9/11. Persecuted FEMA 9/11 photographer fights extradition, by Pat Shannon. For 5 weeks following the 9/11 attacks, high-ranking FEMA official Kurt Sonnenfeld was given unlimited access to the various crime scenes as an official videographer. However, when Sonnenfeld discovered that his official documentation contradicted the U.S. government's account of the events, he refused to be a part of a cover-up and did not turn over the tapes to officialdom. This was when his troubles began, and 7 years ago he fled to Argentina in fear for his life, but remains in possession of the video evidence. For the U.S. government, Sonnenfeld, 41, is a troublesome witness on the loose whose documented evidence can expose its fraudulent account of 9/11. This places him in a unique but extremely vulnerable position. He was jailed for 7 months in 2002 on trumped-up charges before being exonerated by a Denver court. They had 2 favorable rulings by an Argentine federal court and 2 more by the Argentine Supreme Court, and Sonnenfeld has a total of 5 impartial courts that have now looked at the evidence and ruled in his favor. However, the federal government is determined to do whatever it takes to retrieve Sonnenfeld's material and silence him. This has converted him into the refugee that he never meant to be. Although many of his large format tapes were stolen during his imprisonment, he still had some videos that were in a box of junk cassettes marked Recycle. His description of the actual happenings of 9/11 from his book, The Persecuted, reads like a report from the pages of American Free Press. He points out that, although independent commissions for tragedies of this magnitude are customary, there has never been one. From the beginning, the investigation of the World Trade Center attacks was tightly controlled by the White House. Now, almost all of the evidence has been destroyed. Sonnenfeld writes, "There are many who say that the wildest conspiracy theory of all is the one offered by the United States government, based on his observations. Did you know that? On the weekend prior to the World Trade Center attacks, all electricity was cut off for approximately 36 hours, including the security cameras and control systems in a highly irregular maintenance operation. In the weeks leading up to the attacks, there were several unusual evacuations of both towers. The company in charge of security at the World Trade Center, Securicom, was directed by Marvin Bush, George W. Bush's younger brother, and Wirt Walker III, George W. Bush's cousin. Hundreds of government personnel were pre-positioned in New York City on September 10th, and FEMA officials had already set up their command post at Pier 92 near the World Trade Center 1 day before the attacks. Sonnenfeld's report on WT-6 is as explosive as what AFP has repeatedly reported about the implosion of WTC-7 after 5 p.m. Sonnenfeld's report on WTC-6 is as explosive as what AFP has repeatedly reported about the implosion of WTC-7 after 5 p.m. When the North Tower fell, WTC-6 was crushed and incinerated. Descending with a special task force to investigate, Sonnenfeld found the badly damaged steel door to the vault with a combination code keypad in the cinder block wall beside it. But the wall was crumbled, and the door was sprung partially open. Checking inside with flashlights, they saw it had been emptied and knew that because of the necessity of a large truck to accomplish this and the utter impossibility of one now getting through the traffic and police blockade, the removal had to have occurred beforehand. Sonnenfeld says, "The Secret Service, the Department of Defense, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Internal Revenue Service, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Office of Emergency Management's Crisis Center occupied huge amounts of space in WTC-7. Other federal agencies had offices there as well. After September 11, it was discovered that concealed within WTC-7 was the largest clandestine domestic station of the Central Intelligence Agency outside of Washington, D.C., a base of operations from which to spy on diplomats of the United Nations and to conduct counterintelligence missions. But the 9/11 Commission report not only avoided much of these facts, it did not even mention WTC-7 or the bizarre circumstances surrounding the collapse. Nor did NIST, the government agency assigned to investigate the collapse of the Twin Towers, writes Sonnenfeld. Like the 9/11 Commission, they completely ignored the suspicious collapse of Building 7, procrastinating the publication of their report time and again. Given Sonnenfeld's claims, there is no surprise the U.S. government is still hunting him. The Argentine government has twice denied U.S. extradition requests, claiming specious pretenses, and is now ignoring a third attempt, this one by Interpol. Sonnenfeld says that for added protection, he has released photos, documents, and videos to important investigators around the world in the United States, Argentina, Western Europe, Central Europe, whose names, of course, he cannot reveal. With no intention of ever voluntarily returning to his homeland, he is keenly aware that U.S. authorities have kidnapped targets in the past. Based on all of the malicious actions undertaken thus far by U.S. authorities, it's obvious that they have no intention of conducting a fair trial, said Sonnenfeld. They would probably claim that I confessed on the flight back, if in fact I actually made it back, or worse still, that I tried to escape, and we know what that would mean. What is sure is that you would not hear from me again. Page 12, On the Mark, with Paul Craig Roberts. U.S. foreign policy breeds terrorism. Muslim nations still the target of neocon machinations in Africa, Mideast, by Paul Craig Roberts. Does anyone remember the cakewalk war that would last no more than 6 weeks, cost $50 to $60 billion, and be paid for out of Iraqi oil revenues? Does anyone remember that White House economist Lawrence Lindsay was fired by W because Lindsay estimated that the Iraq war could cost as much as $200 billion? Lindsay was fired for overestimating the cost of a war that, according to Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, had cost 15 times more than Lindsay estimated, and the U.S. still has 50,000 troops in Iraq. Does anyone remember that just prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. government declared victory over the Taliban in Afghanistan? Does anyone remember that the reason W gave for invading Iraq was Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, weapons that the U.S. government knew did not exist? Are Americans aware that the same neoconservatives who made these fantastic mistakes or told these fabulous lies are still in control of the government in Washington? The war on terror is now in its 10th year. What is it really all about? The bottom line answer is that the war on terror is about creating real terrorists. The U.S. government desperately needs real terrorists in order to justify its expansion of its wars against Muslim countries and to keep the American people sufficiently fearful that they continue to accept the police state that provides security from terrorists but not from the government that has discarded civil liberties. The U.S. government creates terrorists by invading Muslim countries, wrecking infrastructure, and killing vast numbers of civilians. The United States also creates terrorists by installing puppet governments to rule over Muslims and by using the puppet governments to murder and persecute citizens, as is occurring on a vast scale in Pakistan today. Neoconservatives use 9/11 to launch their plan for U.S. world hegemony. Their plan fit with the interests of America's ruling oligarchies. Wars are good for the profits of the military security complex, about which President Eisenhower warned us in vain a half century ago. American hegemony is good for the oil industry's control over resources and resource flows. The transformation of the Middle East into a vast American puppet state serves well the Israel lobby's Zionist aspirations for Israeli territorial expansion. Earlier this year, Deputy U.S. Treasury Secretary Neil Wallen ordered Pakistan to raise taxes so that the Pakistani government could more effectively make war on its own citizens for the Americans. On October 14th, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton ordered Pakistan to again raise taxes or the U.S. would withhold flood aid. Mrs. Clinton pressured America's European puppet states to do the same, expressing in the same breath that the U.S. government was worried by British cuts in the military budget. God forbid that the hard-pressed British, still reeling from financial fraud, don't allocate enough money to fight America's wars. In his book, Obama's Wars, Bob Woodward reports that America's puppet president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, believes that terrorist bombing attacks inside Pakistan, for which the Taliban are blamed, are in fact CIA operations designed to destabilize Pakistan and allow Washington to seize Pakistan's nuclear weapons. To keep Pakistan in line, the U.S. government changed its position that the Times Square bombing was the work of a lone wolf. Attorney General Eric Holder switched the blame to the Pakistani Taliban, and Mrs. Clinton threatened Pakistan with very serious consequences for the unsuccessful Times Square bombing, which likely was a false flag operation aimed at Pakistan. For decades, the U.S. government has enabled repeated Israeli military aggression against Lebanon and now appears to be getting into gear for another Israeli assault on the former American protectorate of Lebanon. On October 14th, the U.S. government expressed its outrage that the Lebanese government had permitted a visit by Iranian President Ahmadinejad, who was the focus of Washington's intense demonization efforts. Israel's representatives in the U.S. Congress threatened to stop U.S. military aid to Lebanon, forgetting that Representative Howard Berman, Democrat California, has had aid to Lebanon blocked since last August to punish Lebanon for a border clash with Israel. Perhaps the most telling headline of all is the October 14th report, Somalia's new American Prime Minister. An American has been installed as the Prime Minister of Somalia. An American puppet government in Mogadishu backed up by thousands of Ugandan troops paid by Washington. Meanwhile, to silence the whistleblower website WikiLeaks and to prevent any more revelations of American war crimes, the Freedom and Democracy government in D.C. has closed down WikiLeaks donations by placing the company that collects its money on its watch list and by having the Australian puppet government blacklist WikiLeaks. Page 13, AFP on the war against Iraq. Iraq, a neocon nightmare. Massive civilian deaths due to U.S. invasion leave America despised, by Richard Walker. The final nails are being driven into the coffin holding the remains of the neoconservative dream of Iraq as an American puppet state that would have provided a massive oil reservoir for decades to come, and also a buffer against Israel's enemies, Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. The recently released WikiLeaks documents detailing America's involvement in Iraq are sufficient testimony to a cruel hoax played on the American public by the likes of Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and George W. Bush, not to mention former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The documents show how the excesses of mercenaries in Iraq led to the killing of civilians. They also confirm how the neocons built a second army run by the private sector that is so large that there are more mercenaries today in Afghanistan than U.S. troops. WikiLeaks is a website that allows whistleblowers to anonymously leak official documents, audio, and videos so that the information gets out to the world and avoids the filters put into place by the controlled media. Worse are revelations that show how Rumsfeld and company ensured no action was taken to prevent the torture of the Iraqi people by Iraqi units trained by the U.S., and how more civilians were killed at U.S. checkpoints than those maintained by Iraqi guerrilla fighters. The leaked documents expose the lie that the Pentagon never kept any account of civilian deaths. What appears in the documents confirms that, aside from the more than 80,000 deaths listed in Pentagon files, there were at least 15,000 unaccounted for. Some estimates put the new total at higher than 120,000. But even before the WikiLeaks release of documents, and with more promised, the death knell for the neocons' Iraq dream had already rung loudly, and no more so than this year. Much to the dismay of the Obama White House, Iraq has gradually lurched politically toward Iran and Lebanon, while the Chinese and Russians have been afforded big oil contracts at the expense of U.S. companies. More significantly, a bane of the neocons, the fiery cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, has become the major power broker in Iraq. Through his auspices, especially his Iranian connections, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been able to stay in power. Obama had hoped, as did the Pentagon and the neocons still within it, that Washington's ally, Iyad Alawi, a former CIA asset, would garner enough support to form a parliamentary coalition with al-Maliki, embracing a large enough delegation of Shia and Sunnis. Al-Sadr quickly made it clear to al-Maliki that it would be a disastrous move because Sadrists in the parliament would bring him down. If al-Maliki did not see sense in that, others succeeded in convincing him. In September, he attended a private meeting in Iran hosted by al-Sadr, General Qasem Soleimani of the Al-Quds Division of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, a representative of Syria's President Assad, and a senior representative from Hezbollah, who carried a message from Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, that a coalition between al-Maliki and al-Sadr would be better for Iraq and the region. Al-Maliki agreed, and the loser in the deal were the Obama White House and Israel. Al-Maliki's decision showed that he no longer feared Washington and its allies in the region, especially Jordan, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. As for al-Sadr, his traditional opposition to Washington is sure to harden as he becomes more politically powerful in the years to come. The most striking aspect of this new coalition is how it highlights the fraudulent claims by Israel and its Washington allies in 2001 that toppling Saddam Hussein would would eliminate the possibility of a Shiite alliance between Iraq's majority and its co-religionists in Iran and Lebanon. Now we know the opposite has occurred, and Iran and its allies in the region are re-energized. Remember, there was high-blown rhetoric by the neocons assuring the American public that Iraq's oil revenues would pay for the war and then some. That lie is further compounded by a new reality. China and Russia, who were never part of the war, are being treated like liberators and are being offered the best oil research and development contracts. Turkey and India have also courted Iraq and Iran, both ready to ignore U.S.-Israeli policy on Iran in favor of economic gain. One of the emerging features of today's Iraq policy is Obama's willingness to allow the Pentagon to slow down the planned exit of U.S. troops from Iraq, which is due to be completed by the end of 2011. That has been done in response to Israeli pressure and the view of some military hawks that a strike against Iran would require a sizable U.S. force in Iraq. That has gone unnoticed in Iraq and among its allies in Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. It may well be that the U.S. plan to leave 30,000 or more troops in Iraq after December 2011 will be vetoed by the new political alliance of al-Sadr and al-Maliki. The best thing for the United States would be to be booted out of Iraq. Page 14. Eye on Israel. Israel sees massive housing boom thanks to AIG, American taxpayers, by Ralph Forbes. While the value of homes plummeted in the United States and bankers foreclosed on 102,134 properties in September amid the robo-signing eviction scandal, Israel has emerged as one of the hottest property markets in the world. According to the Jerusalem Post, when Stanley Fisher speaks, Ben Bernanke listens. While Bernanke tries to keep the dollar afloat, his mentor, Stanley Fisher, governor of the Bank of Israel, announced his sixth rate hike this year. The government's policy is to bring in money from wealthy Jews worldwide to invest in new houses on Palestinian lands occupied by Israel. This policy has hurt all Israelis who are not in the privileged ruling caste. The price of an average apartment in Jerusalem rose 19% to 1.55 million shekels, or $403,000, at the end of June from 1.31 million shekels a year earlier. When the manipulations wrought by the big bankers caused the economy to collapse, to keep the bankers' economic system and the state of Israel from being hurt, a corrupt Congress looted trillions of dollars from the pockets of the American people. Headlines across Israel gloated, such as this: U.S. government takeover of mortgage giants good for Israeli banks. On March 3, 2009, the following exchange between Bernanke and independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders took place in the hallowed halls of what used to be known as the Congress of a Constitutional Republic. Sanders, will you tell the American people to whom you lent $2.2 trillion of their dollars? Bernanke, no. With one word, Bernanke revealed who really runs the United States. As of March 4, 2009, Bernanke and gang had slipped $163 billion, courtesy of the American taxpayer, to the American International Group, AIG. President Obama, Senator Christopher Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, and all the politicians whined we had to give billions to AIG or the sky would fall. However, the sky didn't fall in Israel because AIG used your money to sell luxurious houses for 0 to 5% down. AIG owns a company in Israel called Ezer Mortgage Insurance, EMI, which will insure or finance up to 95% of a private Israeli mortgage. Below is the wording of EMI's nifty ad. It's so simple to purchase a house in Israel when EMI, a member of AIG, American International Group, makes up to 95% financing possible. EMI sets the premium as a function of the LTV, loan-to-value ratio, and the term of the loan. As a rule of thumb, for every $100,000 of a loan taken by a borrower, the borrower pays an additional $25 a month. So, with the U.S. economy becoming more and more devastated, Israelis are getting flexible deals on stolen land after Palestinians are forcibly evicted from their homes, and their homes, often owned by the same family for generations, are bulldozed. Compared to the Palestinians evicted at gunpoint or via bulldozer, the hundreds of thousands of newly homeless Americans and the millions of Americans threatened with foreclosure can count their blessings. Or are we all Palestinians now? Page 15. The News Hound with Jim Tucker. Patriot Group unmasks traitors on American shores by James P. Tucker, Jr. A platoon of traitors in high places was unmasked by a Patriot group during discussions with reporters in Washington on October 21st. The documentation provided by the group, America's Survival, identifies communists and other subversives over many years who have sought to undermine the United States. A flagship of the left-wing part of the corporate media, the Washington Post, suppressed the shocking story. With the Cold War over, their mission now is to impose a communist style system under a world government, reports America's Survival. According to that group, a press statement by Weather Underground leader Bill Ayers, a self-avowed communist and a longtime friend of President Obama, Ayers is now a tenured professor, boasts of the struggle against imperialism to achieve a better, more human life for all the people of the world under communism. His bunkmate and fellow communist, Bernadine Dorn, railed about the unspeakable crimes of Americans. Both spent years in prison for perpetrating acts of violence and destruction on American soil. FBI files provided by the group say that the late Harry Hay of Los Angeles was a member of the Communist Party USA for many years and founded the modern movement for homosexual rights. He was involved with the communist Daily People's World. As an instructor at various schools, Hay taught Marxism and recruited students to the communist cause. Cliff Kincaid, president of America's Survival, tells how journalism educators brainwashed today's newspapermen and broadcasters, accounting for the predominance of the left-wing extremists in the media. With the advent of state-run media, journalists act as shills for the Obama White House, Kincaid says. Washington Post reporter Karen DeYoung told the left-wing Institute for Policy Studies seminar the communist guerrilla groups in Central America were considered the good guys, Kincaid says. Curtis McDougall, the author of Interpretive Reporting, has been named one of the makers of the media mind in a book by William David Sloan, Makers of the Media Mind, published by America's Survival, Kincaid says. Interpretive reporting was a standard text in journalism schools for more than 50 years, used at one time or another by almost every journalism program in the country. McDougall was investigated by the FBI because of his ties to Soviet agents. The group also quotes Obama's book, Dreams from My Father. I chose my friends carefully, the Marxist professors and structural feminists and punk rock performance poets. We smoked cigarettes and wore leather jackets. For more, visit the website of America's Survival at usasurvival.org. Page 17, The Ryan Report. The Art of Successful Politics by Vince Ryan. We live in an age of so-called transparency, in which it is hoped that all facets of society and government are open books for everyone to read. But hopes and dreams don't always come true in life or in political action. Party platforms and political manifestos usually go the way of campaign promises. Whatever it takes or is necessary for a candidate to say or do in order to win an election is of prime importance. But after the lucky poll takes the oath of office, and is challenged by friend or foe about not keeping his promises, the usual excuse he gives the lowly voter is, "You don't understand the pressures in this job, but I am doing my very best." There are some members of Congress, I think my congressman is one, who don't spend an excessive amount of time making promises they can't always keep, but who do enjoy enumerating their past achievements, which serve as building blocks for legislation that will please the majority of their constituents. New members of Congress who will be sworn in next January will quickly learn that the main reason they are there is to get reelected. Like good wine, they are supposed to mellow with age, and over the coming months and years, they will be the objects of heavy lobbying by highly paid and very skillful representatives of organizations, and even by private citizens or organizations who are often but not necessarily from their own districts. Now the professional lobbyists can also provide access to people knowledgeable about the workings of Congress, staffing, bill crafting, media relations, and fundraising, among others. But they must be honest and free from the taint of bribery in all their undertakings. Bear in mind that in this age of transparency, lobbyists, like the politicians they deal with, are watched not only by government regulators, but by those whose sole purpose is to find some fault in their work, that could destroy them or the congressman with whom they deal. If you are interested in finding out who contributes to your representative and senators, take a look at the internet website campaignmoney.com. The names of organizations and individuals who are active are there for you to evaluate. Notice the many corporate and individual contributors who have an interest in getting your representative and senators in Congress to vote for what they advocate. As you know, outside grassroots forces have had a big impact on elections. Of course, old standbys like labor unions and the various business organizations, both conservative and liberal, have been active. The exciting new kid on the block, the Tea Party movement, hopes to remain a power in elections to come. Many professional politicians fear it and hope it is a temporary phenomenon. Others have compared its potential future influence to that of the Liberal League of Women Voters founded in 1920. The media still prefers to reserve their A's or nays for conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats. The rest of the candidates are often consigned to the political waste bin labeled kooks. But what the people are longing for are dynamic candidates, especially for president, who are nationalists and populists in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Reverend Charles Coughlin, and Senator Robert A. Taft. A populist glossary by populist editor and writer Willis A. Cardo defines conservatism. While theoretically favoring less government and opposing socialism, the average conservative supports all essentials of capitalism and therefore the very fundamentals which inevitably produce socialism. Conservatives are misled by their leaders into supporting big business, free trade, and internationalism, including military intervention in useless wars. Unclear or contradictory in many areas, conservatism is distinctly liberal in others, or diligently avoids controversy in regards to Zionism, race, money, and banking, and trilateralism. On the other hand, he defines liberalism this way: shifting arguments of sentimentalism used by Marxists, minorities, and capitalists break down traditional society. All matoids, criminals of high intelligence, are liberals who are unable to see the consequences of the policies they advocate. Above all, no matter the case or circumstances of an issue or action, truth must prevail. Without truth, all words, deeds, actions, and promises are meaningless. A free people and their leaders must always set truth as their highest goal. Page 19. Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Forget the audit, just abolish the Federal Reserve. On March 17, 1993, I addressed the House of Representatives in one of the many budget debates. Over the past 16 years, many publications and books have reprinted my speech. They viewed my speech as being on target. Researchers have written to me regarding the speech, confused because it was printed in two areas of the congressional record. My floor remarks were brief, but I inserted the entire speech into the extension of remarks section of the record. Nevertheless, the speech stands today as prophetic. America is bankrupt, and it's growing worse by the day. Fact: the U.S. government was technically dissolved by the Emergency Banking Act of March 9, 1933. If you have any doubt, just look around. Foreclosures and unemployment are rampant. The dollar is dropping so low it could fit under a closed door with a top hat on. Yet, every day the mainstream media is trying to convince us that the recession is over. Who's kidding whom? If you take Social Security and Medicare out of our economy, it's a full-blown depression. A total belly-up depression. The real rub emanates from the fact that the trustees who preside over U.S. bankruptcy are the international bankers via the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. I proclaim that all U.S. offices, officials, and departments are now operating within a de facto status in name only under emergency war power. Our constitutional form of government was technically dissolved and replaced by a so-called democracy, a government in actuality being a socialist communist order under a new governor for America. You must be thinking that I've lost my marbles by now. I don't blame you, but here come the facts. This chicanery occurred when authority was transferred and placed in the office of the Secretary of Treasury under the governor of the International Monetary Fund. Public Law 94-564. In essence, the dollar was changed from a promise to pay a dollar in silver or gold to a Federal Reserve note. Now think about it. The dollar became a note, not money. The new U.S. dollar is a debt instrument. Nothing more than another debt obligation of the American people. And where is this obligation to be paid? You probably guessed it, to the Federal Reserve Bank. Let's tell it like it is. Federal Reserve notes are literally unsigned checks written on a closed account. It's nothing more than inflatable paper creating more debt through inflation every time our currency is devalued. Truth is, inflation is actually another tax. Invisible, never seen, but a tax just the same. I don't know about you, but I always thought that a contract under common law is only valid if it involves an exchange of some good and valuable consideration. If that's not enough to frost your pumpkins, check this out. The Federal Reserve System is a sovereign power structure separate and distinct from the U.S. government. It is, in fact, a private corporation. We, the people of these United States, owe this private corporation consisting of international bankers a mountain of debt. The collateral on this debt is our very own homes and properties. We, the people, are nothing more than tenants and sharecroppers, renting our own property from the Federal Reserve Bank. Most Americans are mortgaged to the hilt, with few or no assets, working harder and profiting less, constantly in debt to a private corporation they know little or nothing about. Beam me up. This has gone on way too long. Wake up, America. This is nothing more than economic slavery to a bunch of international fat cats. Our Constitution has been turned upside down, violated and discarded like toilet paper. Unbelievable. It's not rocket science, folks. Congress shall coin money, so mandates the Constitution. It's very clear to me, the Federal Reserve System should be abolished. Not just audited so the politicians can feel good, but abolished. Enough is enough. In closing, I say, audit this. Conspiracy fact with Pat Shannon. Obama critic jailed again. FBI to investigate corruption by Pat Shannon. AFP readers will remember former Navy Lieutenant Commander Walt Fitzpatrick III as the man who a year and a half ago first attempted to charge Barry Sotero, aka Barack Obama, with treason for impersonating a president, only to find himself under federal investigation as a potential terrorist. Then the retired naval officer was similarly stonewalled at the state level, but during his quest found statewide corruption in the Tennessee judicial system. On December 1st, he will be facing trial on various ludicrous charges stemming from his attempts to force certain officials to behave lawfully. On October 25th, Special Circuit Judge John K. Blackwood ordered Fitzpatrick held without bond until trial. Fitzpatrick, who had skipped a court hearing the previous week, was arrested 2 days later when a Monroe County, Tennessee SWAT team broke down the door of his home in Sweetwater. However, Fitzpatrick said from the jailhouse that the court had never notified him of the hearing and that this was an intentional setup by Blackwood to railroad him into jail. In Fitzpatrick's absence, Blackwood refused a request by defense attorney Stephen Pidgeon to withdraw from the case. Pidgeon said that he could not discuss the reason for the request, but agrees with Fitzpatrick that Monroe County's grand jury system is hopelessly corrupted, with court-appointed four persons serving decades, stating, "We have now seen four judges, a couple of district attorneys, the governor, and the attorney general of the state of Tennessee involved in protecting a criminal enterprise." Fitzpatrick had recently taken the gloves off with disparaging attacks of various officials in print. Assistant District Attorney General James Stutz said in a previous court filing that rulings in such challenges of grand juror qualifications show there is no limit on the number of two-year terms for which a foreman may be reappointed, but that statement does not accurately coincide with the new law. Fitzpatrick has charged Tennessee judges with ignoring the laws passed by the state's legislature and officially enacted, and he appears to be legally correct. Governor Phil Bredesen signed into Tennessee law a bill setting the jury service term limits on June 13, 2008. This would have rendered illegal all grand jury members who were still seated in 2010, and the signer of the Fitzpatrick indictment in June was Angela Davis, who had been on the grand jury in 2008. In his attempts at seeking justice, Fitzpatrick has met nothing but frustration for over a year and a half. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation has informed him that they cannot even initiate an investigation without first being authorized to do so by the district attorney, who, according to Fitzpatrick's investigation, would never order an investigation of a corrupt judiciary that they themselves are part of. A long internet-published memo to State Senator Mae Beavers, chairwoman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, outlining the dictatorship of the judiciary and the takeover by judges of the grand jury system, has yet to produce even a response. Up until now, his screams of tyranny and dictatorship echoing through the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee have fallen on deaf ears. But Fitzpatrick finally got the FBI to agree to begin an investigation of the Monroe County and Tennessee judiciary systems when he called them from the jailhouse to explain the latest antics by Judge Blackwood to backdoor him into jail. Because the FBI in recent years has proven to be more of a protectorate of the government than an investigative agency, many are dubious of this upcoming investigation.